Yes.
So this is Parsha Under Pressure. And I've often thought to myself, as Orthodox Jews, our capacity to utilize technology is so severely hamstrung by the way that we observe Shabbat, by the way that we keep Shabbat. And imagine if we were Reform. Imagine if we weren't Jewish and we had our houses of worship where I could give a drasha with technology and I could give PowerPoint presentations. Wouldn't it make things more engaging? Of course, we try to find ways to be engaging without the technology. But this, for all the challenges it has imposed, it is also unleashing the capacity for creativity. So you'll have to indulge me with some of the technology. If it doesn't come off, I apologize. But we're going to work our way through the traditional shir. Last week, I just shared the view of the PDF. But today, we're going to dive in with something different. Parshat Tzav. We're going to look at, firstly, as we always do, we're going to go with a big overview, look at the big picture of the parasha. And then we're going to head to a particular pasuk, which we hope to put under pressure. Now, Parshat Tzav, I thought it would be helpful to divide it into aliyot, as we usually would. And we'll start with Rishon. In Rishon, we have, firstly, the mandatory daily removal of the ashes from the altar. Anyone know what that was called?
Harumas HaDeshen.
Excellent. So there were two stages. One was the Trumas HaDeshen and one was the Hotzas HaDeshen. One was every day the ashes had to be piled up from the last day of sacrifices and put on the altar. So initially you had to pile up all these ashes. That was act number one on the altar. And the second act was taking all that ash and removing it from the camp. Now, according to Rashi, that didn't have to be done. That second step didn't have to be done every day. It needed to be emptied out and removed when it became too big, which is often, lahavdil, how I feel about taking out the garbage to the street. Meaning, I understand I've got to get it out of the house, but to take the can to the road, that's a lot of walking. So if it's not that full, and I think I'll make it till the next time, till Thursday or Monday, sometimes I'll say, you know what, I'll give them the day off and I'll take it out on Thursday. So lahavdil, Rashi says with the deshen, you have to pile it up every day. But if it's not an overwhelming amount of ash, you don't have to take it out of the Mishkan every day, just when it becomes cumbersome. Having said that, most Mefarshim, in fact, every other one that I can find, disagrees with him and thinks that these two phases, this two-step process of removing the ashes from the altar had to be done every day, had to be collected into the middle and then taken out. And of course, the question that the commentators ponder is, why the two steps? Why do I have to pile it all up in the corner and then remove it? Just take it out of here. What do I have to pile it up for? And I should note, for those of you are muted, but you should feel free to unmute yourself. If you've got a contribution, a question, a guess, an answer, an insight, you should feel free to chime in. And when it comes to Trumat HaDeshen, it is Rav Hirsch who is most often cited as having the most resonant symbolic insight into this. And he writes at length in his commentary to the Chumash, this piling up of the ash every day, being the first act of ritual service. It's like walking into shul and being the first thing that you do every day. And he suggests that it is a comment on how avodat Hashem, how the service of God, how our spiritual existence has to be premised on our yesterdays, on our past. The first act we have to do is to recognize that without the past, without yesterday's service, without those who came before us, our service is nothing. That everything we do has been set up and arranged and made possible by those who have come before us. I think I mentioned in the past, there was a political candidate for office a few years ago who gave a speech in which he said, if you've got a business, you didn't just build that. And if you ever drive on the road, you didn't build that. And that was then used to fire ads against that candidate, saying he's anti-business, he doesn't like people think they're doing their own thing, it's a socialism thing. And you could take that view. In defense of what he was saying was that the roads that we drive on, I didn't build them. I don't think many of the people listening to the call built them. We didn't build these things. The building that the shul stands on, many of you were involved in. I arrived late on the scene. I didn't build it. And yet we get immense benefit from things that have come before, and to lose consciousness of what comes before undermines what it means to live a religious life. And that's for Rav Hirsch, why we begin every day with looking to the ash from yesterday and bringing it right into the middle, to recognize that it's because of what happened yesterday that I'm here today. And that doesn't even have to be about other people. It can be about the things that we've done yesterday. The religious choices we've made in our life always informs who we are. Having said that, he then adds a dimension of complexity to this by saying the second act is what? The first act was to pile up the ash. What was the second act?
Take it away.
So having now established how central it is to have the past found everything that we do, Rav Hirsch has to account for the fact that we then dispose of those ashes and take the relics and the remnants of yesterday's sacrifice and take them beyond the border and the fence of the camp. And his suggestion there is that we have to tolerate this balance where we rely and recognize everything in the past that has brought us to where we are, but at the same time understand that every day is a new day and that we have to act with fresh enthusiasm and an eager sense of what we're about to do as being a foundational moment to lead us in to tomorrow. So that's just an observation that he makes about that mandatory Trumat Hadeshen, which again, on the surface, can look like an arcane, ritualistic regulation that doesn't really speak to how we should live life other than when we have a temple. And Rav Hirsch finds a way to make it resonate in an age without that. In Rishon, it then moves on to the laws of the Korban Mincha, which we mentioned last week. We then have Sheni. And in Sheni, we have the mincha that was brought by the Kohanim first. First, it was brought twice each day by the Kohen Gadol. And then when any priest was inducted into temple service, he got his badge, so to speak, to be a Kohen in the Bet Mikdash. He also brought that mincha. We then repeat the details from last week of the Korban Asham, the guilt offering, the Korban Chatat, the sin offering. And then we look at to something that, again, doesn't seem that pertinent, which is the meats of the sacrifices that were cooked in pots, the taste that was absorbed, how you would remove that taste. And I'm sure for many of you, as you think about preparing for Pesach, the way that we remove taste from vessels is quite central to how we live our lives. And I know many of you have had questions about how to kosher pots and how to kosher spoons and how to kosher dishwashers, which I said I would get back to you about for those of you who were on the call. I think it was earlier this week, but time has kind of bled into each other. The Pesach overview, I said I would get back to you about kasher and dishwashers, and ordinarily, I did get back to the individuals who asked me, but I should also share it publicly. If you have a dishwasher and you're wondering about whether you can use it on Pesach, the determination, at least for this year, has been that any dishwashers that the internal material is either metal or plastic, which includes the racks, you clean out the filter, leave it unused for 24 hours, and then run it on the highest setting. If there's only one setting, that's the highest setting. You run it on one setting without any detergent or soap, just plain hot water, and then you are good to go. What's the story with next year? Ask me in 11 months, but we'll start with that for now. So that's removing the taste and flavors from vessels. Then right at the end of Sheni, we talk about the gifts. The Kohanim can now perk up again, the gifts that Kohanim would get from the different offerings and sacrifices. Now, I noticed last week and the week before, I didn't have the opportunity to mention the Malbim, and I'm feeling a little guilty about that. So I wanted to throw him into the mix here. Because actually his very first drasha, when he was chief rabbi of Romania, touched on not this parsha, but on this concept, that the Kohanim get various gratuities or gifts called Matnot Kohanim, the gifts that the Kohanim got, which is actually described in more detail in Devarim. Anyone know what the three areas of the animal that the Kohen is entitled to? Three areas, you can take a guess. So one is the jaw, l'chayayim. One is the zroa, the arm. And one is the keva, the stomach. And the Malbim's first drasha, and again, I didn't take this route when I started here 7 months ago, but the first drasha he gave was, a Kohen is entitled to these three gifts. We don't have a Bet Mikdash anymore, so the rabbis are the equivalent of Kohanim. I'm entitled to these three things from you. And he wasn't saying, I need you to get me these pieces of the animal, but he then says, metaphorically, these are the things that as a rabbi, I should have. I should have Lechayayim, I should have Keva and Zroa. That means, number one, I should have the jaw. I should have permission to say what I want to say. You need to give me the latitude to express my view, number one. Number two, the zroa. I need to be given power. I need to be given the ability to execute my vision without interference. If Sammy's online, I didn't give this drasha, don't worry about it. Number three, he said, Keva, you need to pay me enough money that I can eat. So those were his three opening demands to his community. Give me the ability to say what I want to say, to do what I want to do, and to be able to feed myself and my family. Nowadays, we tend to sort that out in negotiations before you arrive, not say it to the whole community the first week. But that was his view. And astonishingly enough, as we will learn at Suda Shlishit, please God, the first Shabbos we come back, when we do the Malbim's biography, he was evicted from Romania 5 years later. Not because the government hated him, but because the community got fed up and reported on him to the government. But either way, that was his opening drasha. And I should note, in defense of him as well, it wasn't all about him. He also said that those three gifts, as a rabbi, he was entitled to translate into ritual life as well. He said that men, l'chayayim, give me the gift, don't shave your beard.
Might be the cheapest. Keep
the jawbone, number one. Number two, zroa, keep putting on your tefillin, and you can guess your stomach. What was he going to say? Eat kosher. So he said, keep eating kosher, don't cut your beards, and wear your tefillin. I don't know if those were the three most important things in Jewish life in Bucharest at the time, but he seemed to feel so. Either way, we now turn on to Shlishi. And in Shlishi, we turn to the Korban Todah, the Thanksgiving offering, which next Wednesday morning, we will stop for 9 days saying the reminiscence of in Psukei Dezimra. Every day we say Mizmor LaTodah in Shacharis, which is a memorial to the Korban Todah. We won't say it next week on Wednesday because it involved 10 loaves that were chametz. So you couldn't bring that in the Bet Mikdash of the Pesach. The Korban Todah was brought for four different purposes. Anyone know what the four occasions that you brought the Korban Todah for?
When you bench Gomel.
Exactly. They're the exact same four cases as when you bench Gomel. Crossing the desert, crossing the sea, getting released from jail, or
suffering
from an illness. Excellent. That is exactly what Birchat HaGomel is modeled on the Korban Todah. And of course, those are the three discrete cases that are mentioned: crossing a desert, crossing a sea, recovering from illness, or getting freed from jail. How many of you bench Gomel when you fly on a plane?
Yes.
So there are a number. Some don't. Because funnily enough, the Gemara doesn't list flying on a plane as necessitating a Korban Todah or necessitating Berachat HaGomel. If you're flying internationally, most of the time you'll be flying over huge bodies of water. But if I take a flight from somewhere domestic here, it could be that I don't. Could be that I don't fly over Nevada and the desert there either. But many people feel that it wasn't safe. It was kind of a risky journey. So I say Birchat HaGomel when I land. Rav Lichtenstein didn't feel that one necessitated saying Birchat HaGomel after flying. And I have not done that since I was in Gush, though I will admit that I'm not always secure that I will remain in that position. But that's how I feel at the moment. Now, that's the Korban Todah. There are some details about the Korban Todah that stand out, but it's not going to be the pasuk we put under pressure, so I'll mention it relatively briefly. It is the only Korban that it says, Yadav Tivi'ena. Whoever brings it their hands shall bring it in. Every other korban, it just lists. You bring it to the Beit Mikdash, and it will get slaughtered, and the blood will get sprinkled, and it will get burnt, and it will get split up and either eaten or incinerated. But at no point does it say, Yadav to Vienna, your hands have to bring it. With the korban todah, it does say those words. And the Kli Yakar suggests that this is an indication, characteristically, that gratitude cannot be outsourced. Yadav to Vienna. That if you are confessing a sin, if you are coming to express guilt or doubt over sin, you can in some way have a level of agency where others represent you. But when you are offering gratitude, a korban todah, when you're giving thanks, there cannot be an agent to express it in the fullest sense. How does that manifest every day when one has the opportunity to daven in a minyan? In the repetition of the Amida, there's only one point at which everybody joins in, other than Kedusha and Amen. There's only one brother.
Modim de Rabbanan.
Correct. We all dive in at Modim, and the Abu Draham, who is a medieval Sephardi philosopher, commentator, and exegete, says that the reason we all jump in and say Modim, which has a different script, is because the Shliach Tzibur, who is literally an agent of the congregation, cannot represent me in expressing gratitude. Gratitude has to be expressed at source by the person who is grateful. And that, I think, is a lasting lesson. It's also worth pointing out that, strictly speaking, the Korban Todah is a Kodshim Kalim. It is of the more lenient sanctities among Korbanot, which means in theory you should get a day and a half to eat it. But you only have a day to eat it, which is more for the Kodshim, the higher sanctity sacrifices. And the Netziv suggests that you have less time to eat it, so that you have to have more people join in because it has to be finished off. And you have to invite more people to finish it off quicker, which the Netziv suggests is in order to make gratitude as public as possible. We bring in the time limit on eating, so you have to have more people, you have to bring it yourself, and you have to do it publicly. Again, it's not always easy, and it's not always appropriate, I guess, to stand forward in front of everybody and confess gratitude, but it is the highest expression of thanks to do it on one's own and to do it in public. So that's Shlishi. It then talks about the grounds for invalidating a sacrifice, which include improper intent on the part of the Kohen. We have a command not to eat blood or any of the chelev, the fats that are put on the Mizbeach, which applies generally as well to domesticated animals, to behemoth. And then we look at what the Kohanim get from the Shlamim. Now, turn to Revi, and we get to the induction process. Now, in which parsha is the Mishkan actually inaugurated?
Shmini.
Parshat Shmini, which in our liturgical experience is going to feel a world away, because we don't learn Parashat Shmini until the Shabbos after Pesach, and we're going to have a lot going on in our lives between now and then. But really, this week bleeds right into the inauguration of the Mishkan. Vayhi b'yom ha-Shmini, and it was on the eighth day that the inauguration was complete, and that builds up from halfway through Parashat Tzav. The priests begin to be inducted or induced. Well, none of them are giving birth, so I guess they're being inducted. And that begins in Revi. In Chamishi, it continues. Moshe sacrifices some of the korbanot, and then in Shishi, he then sacrifices more korbanot, and then in Shavii, he does a very strange thing. He douses the Kohen Gadol and the Kohanim with blood and oil as an inauguration. Now, where does that blood and oil go? Anybody know where he dabs them? Norman got it right, even
right
just thumb. Gesture.
The right thumb.
The right thumb and?
His ear.
The right earlobe and?
His toe.
The right big toe. Three locations, very odd locations to be daubing the Kohen Gadol and the other Kohanim on their right earlobe, on their right big thumb, and on their, well, you only got one size thumb, on your right thumb and on your right big toe. It's incredibly strange. And that is going to be precisely the pasuk that we put under pressure this evening. So let us turn to this moment, which we have excellently depicted on your screen. Apparently that's Moshe on the right-hand side, putting blood on a perplexed-looking high priest. What on earth are you doing? And of course, he was instructed to do so, as we will read in this week's pasuk that we will put under pressure. V'yakrev et ha'ayil ha'sheni. And Moses took the second ram, El Hamiluim, it was the ram of ordination, meaning it was the Korban Shlamim, not the Chatat, it was the Shlamim. V'yismechu Aaron Avanav et Yedeim al Rosh Ha'ayil, Aaron and his sons put their hands on top of the head of this ram. V'yishchat. Anyone see what's on top of V'yishchat?
Shalshelet.
That's the Shalshelet. It is the rarest of the notes that is found in the laning trop. Anyone know how many times it comes up?
Four.
For a long time, I thought it was three because it's shalosh, shalshelet, and for some reason that got ingrained in my head. But yes, it is indeed four different times, one of which is in my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, so I remember that. It comes up when
low. A kane para is even more rare.
Oh, all right. Yeah, you're right. I withdraw my statement. The second rarest of notes in the laning. It would have been more.
And the Yarche Ben Yoma also is rare.
Which one?
Yarche Ben Yoma.
Okay, so we're going to stop with the rarity thing now. Shalshelet is an incredibly rare note in the laning. I don't do laning that much, you may be able to tell. It's not that often. What are the four cases where Shalshelet comes up? Number one is right now in the inauguration process of the Bet Mikdash when Moshe sacrifices one of the goats. Second, what's the first case that comes up? So Vayit Ma'amai is actually the second time. The second time.
Vayomar.
Vayomar, okay. That would have been a good guess. That's probably the most, most common word in the Torah. But yes.
Vayomar, by Yosef.
Vayomar, yeah. And then you have Eliezer.
Excellent. We got them all. Number one, when Eliezer is sent on his errand to go and find a wife for Yitzchak, he responds by Yomar, and the Shalshelet appears there. When Lot is trying to be forced out by the angels to save his life, he hesitates, V'yit Ma'ama, in Sodom, the second Shalshelet arises. When Yosef is being seduced by Potiphar's wife, V'yma'en, and he resists, we have the Shalshelet again, and this is the fourth, and a discussion of why in each case as that appears would be incredibly worthwhile, and maybe we'll talk about that tomorrow. Maybe we won't, but either way, it's worth thinking about. So let's continue. V'yishchat, Moshe slaughtered this ram. V'yikach Moshe midamo, Moses took from its blood. V'yiten al tenochat Aaron ha'imaneh, and he put it on the right elo of Aaron. V'al bo'en yado ha'imaneh, and on his right thumb. V'al bo'en raglo ha'imaneh, and I won't lift my big toe up to the camera, but on his right hand, or right foot, big toe. And of course the question is, why on earth is he putting the blood of a ram on Aaron's earlobe, toe, and thumb? And there are a number of ways that this has been read through history. And I'm going to open us to a couple of options along the way. The first is a figure called Jacob Milgram. Anyone know Jacob Milgram? So he is not the Milgram who is responsible for the psychological experiment that involved prisons. Anyone aware of that?
Yes.
Yeah, this is a different guy. He's a scholar of biblical studies. I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he may be. Steve's shaking his head, so he may not be, or you're just shaking your head. You're muted, but I heard you. I see you. You're still muted, but I'll believe you. When you unmute yourself, you can let us know. So Jacob Milgram says this fascinating possibility. He says it can be seen that the blood daubing of the altar's extremities, its horns, closely resembles the blood daubing of the priest's extremities. And the suggestion here, the way that this comment has been read, is that in the same way that the altar had to be sacrificially activated by having its extremities daubed with blood to almost touch on its borders to engage its center in sanctity. That's precisely what's happening with the Kohen. It has to be on his earlobe and on his thumb and on his toe in order to signify him as a sacred platform in order to perform the sacred service. Of course, at a symbolic level, it's making a statement about who the Kohen is as a functionary. What is his role? And the claim that Milgram's point would seem to be making implicitly is his role is to be an altar. His role is to be the platform for sacrifice. He is really just a means to an end, and that end is, what is the end? What's the end of sacrifice? What's the point of sacrifice?
To get closer.
To get closer to God. So really, he is a mechanism in this reading for bridging the people and God through his ritual labor. That's Jacob Milgram. Now, Philo, who was also a biblical scholar, but certainly is not still alive, as far as I'm aware, was a Greek-Jewish philosopher who our research suggests actually did not read the Bible in Hebrew. He read it in Greek. He lived in Alexandria a long time ago and is one of the most famed exegetes of the age in the rabbinic period. And he very much dove into what is called allegorical readings, metaphor, which got people in a lot of trouble later in history. I'll give you one example. I know time's rushing on, so we'll have to speed up. But one example from Philo about symbolic allegorical reading. Kosher animals. What are the two signals of a kosher animal?
Chews cud, split hoof.
Chews cud, and Norman's muted, but I saw him say split hooves. So yes, those are the two symbols. Split hooves and chews the cud, which means that they eat their food and then they regurgitate it a few times before they eat it. Now, twice? Okay, there you go. So here's my question. Why? If I'm sitting here in the year 2020, and I'm considering, I'm an atheist, I've never been brought up in a religion, I'm deciding where to go, and someone says, oh, Judaism is such a moving, meaningful faith. Why don't you join the Jewish faith? And they say, okay, what are some of the rules? They say, okay, well, there's kosher food. Okay, so what animals are kosher? Any animal has got split hooves and chews the cud. Okay, why? That's just what it is. And the truth is, at core, it is a chok. It is something that we don't have an answer to. It is established, inscrutable statute. But Philo suggests that there is a philosophical, pedagogical message at the core of those two rules. A split hoof indicates that we need to have the capacity to be discerning, to make distinctions, to be analytical, to think about right and wrong. And number two, why does chewing the cud have a role?
Because they're not carnivores.
Okay, so that's fascinating. The suggestion that chewing the cud is usually behavior of animals that are not carnivorous. I can't remember what the alternative to being a carnivore is. Herbivore. Thank you. That are herbivorous. And there's a lesson there, perhaps. Philo is not on with the animal rights movement yet. So he suggests that, again, it's about abstract mental acuity, and it's about reviewing material. And these are the two principles of pedagogical life, the need to be analytical and the need to be in constant review, which again breathes meaning into what might seem like abstract and meaningless ritual. But you get in trouble because then in response to Philo, you can say, oh, that's a lovely thought. I'll jot down the thought. I'll bear that in mind and I'll go and eat some pig. You know, I've now got the idea. So why do I need to observe the ritual, which of course in the medieval period led to a number of book burnings because the Rambam's followers, Maimonides' followers, embraced this allegorical understanding of religious life and of biblical interpretation, which bled out to a whole movement of allegorists who said ritual observance is less important than the messages that they project, in which case religious life tends to start to decline. So Philo got in trouble for that, but either way, he's going to make the same metaphorical connection to our apparently abstract ritual. And he says the fully consecrated must be pure in words, in action, and in life. Words are judged by hearing. So Aaron has blood put on his earlobe because he needs to be careful in his words. He has blood put on his hand because hand is a symbol of action. And we need to act in a upright manner, and it needs to be on our foot. And this is where the metaphor gets stretched, because the foot is the symbol of the pilgrimage of life. Anyone know what to make of that? I'm sure we could, but it's a bit of a stretch, but it is the position that Chief Rabbi Hertz takes in his Chumash. He says, the ear was touched with the blood that it might be consecrated to hear the word of God, the hand to perform the duties connected with priesthood, and the foot to walk the path of righteousness. So this threefold daubing of blood on Aaron's extremities, on his earlobe, his thumb, and his big toe was to communicate for these three thinkers three different metaphorical ideas about living one's life with integrity in speech, in action, and then also on the pilgrimage of life, whatever you would like to make of that. Now, we move on from these rational allegorists, let's call them, and we turn the page, or literally get shown a new page, and we turn to Rabbeinu Bachya. And Rabbeinu Bachya is, in many ways, the first figure to publicize mysticism, Jewish mysticism. It was his mentor, the Ramban, who first inaugurated a public exhibition of mysticism in his commentary to the Chumash. But Rabbeinu Bachya made huge efforts to publicize it. And he suggests that this threefold ritual corresponds very neatly to a pattern that is embedded in the cosmos. Let's look at the Hebrew. Does anybody else want to read this for me? I feel like I'm doing a lot of speaking, which is generally how I might feel. But anybody want to read a couple of lines here? Okay. If you do, jump in. Yireli, it seems to me, the Rabbeinu Bachya says, Besidur Evarim Halalu, in the arrangement of these limbs, meaning the earlobe and the thumb and the big toe, because existence itself, reality itself, is divided into three spheres. Olam HaMelachim, the realm of the angels. Olam HaGilgalim, the realm of the celestial bodies, meaning the planets and the stars and the sun and the moon. Olam HaShefel, and the lower reality, which of course is material life on earth. And he suggests, we're not going to read it all inside, he suggests next, Nitzaveh Moshe Mishkan, Moses divided the Mishkan into these three spheres as well. You have Lifnim in HaParochet, within the curtain, the Kodesh Kodashim, which corresponds to the angelic realm. You have the Kodesh itself outside of the curtain, but within the hall, which corresponds to the Olam HaGilgalim, the celestial bodies, and the Chatzer, the courtyard outside the Mishkan, which corresponds to earthly life. And then he says, Alkein Hutzrach HaMishkan HaZeh Liot Sham Echad, which is why precisely the Mishkan, modeled on the cosmos, modeled on the cosmic hierarchy of angels and celestial bodies and material life, the Mishkan is also organized by one being. Who organizes the Mishkan? Who is the overseer of ritual life in the temple?
Kohen Gadol.
Correct. The Kohen Gadol. And the Kohen Gadol, why is there a need for hierarchy? You would have said, why not just alternate or have different people pick up the load? And he suggested actually the hierarchy is very theologically pertinent because he represents the divine hand of providence that organizes the cosmos and the universe. And then he said, Vazuhi Surat Ha'adam, Shu Olam Katan, and that is precisely the way that man is built. So not only is the cosmos formed in this tripartite manner with the angels and the celestial bodies and earth, and not only is the Mishkan, the Kodesh Kodashim and the Kodesh and the Chatzeh, but the human being has the cerebral realm, which corresponds to the angels, has the life-giving realm, the heart and the lungs that, when all being well, provide us with movement. Like the celestial bodies keep the cosmos in motion, and then everything beneath the stomach and down is the material, digestive, reproductive tracts that belong to the, correspond to the material life on earth. And he suggests that that is precisely why Aaron has his ear, his thumb, and his toe inaugurated to somehow activate him as a body that represents the cosmos, the sacred sphere of the Mishkan, and human beings themselves in a total way. The cerebral, angelic realm of the cosmos, the celestial sphere, the life-giving part of the human being and the material realm as well are all engaged with religious life. Now we have 6 minutes left, so we're going to move to our final reading, and this is our last slide. And our last slide, we go to the Menachem Tzio. I've mentioned him a couple times in the past. The Menachem Tzio, anyone know who he is? I mentioned him a couple times. Rabbi Menachem B.
Sacks.
Excellent. Rabbi Menachem B. Sacks, who was from Chicago. He organized the Association of Talmud Torahs, the ATT in Chicago, I mentioned as well. He was the late grandfather of Rav Yonason Sacks, the Rosh Yeshiva of Landers College Torah. And he has the following suggestion, that this is not because Rabbeinu Bachya has a nice symmetry to his idea that the cosmic realm and the sacred realm and the human realm correspond in a neat way. But it doesn't always resonate to those of us who are less mystically inclined. What is the message here? And Rav Hertz, we have to give him and Philo and Jacob Milgram credit for their allegorical gymnastics. But again, the pilgrimage of life was a bit of a stretch. What are we to make of this idea? And he suggests that right at root, the role of the Kohen is leadership. And right at root of this inauguration ritual, these three body parts are being engaged precisely for that purpose. And this is what he says, and we'll read some of this. We've got 5 minutes. Moshe natan dam al tenocha ozen. Moshe put blood on the earlobe, asher alea lahaazin, because the high priest being inaugurated, and if this helps you, think about, imagine for a moment, the president of the United States is being inaugurated. We have our own rituals in America. They put their hand on the Bible. You have various singers, poets, performances, choirs, anthems that are sung. And here, as the high priest is being inaugurated, we're not just activating the cosmos on some mystic level. He suggests we are teaching the high priest how to lead, what his job is. And here he says, we put blood on the earlobe, because it is to him, l'ha'azim l'hilamot dofek ha'umah, because it is up to him to hear the pounding pulse of the nation. Ozen ha'manhig, the ear of the leader, tzricha liyot ko chadav, ko rigisha, the ear of the leader has to be incredibly sharp and incredibly sensitive. Ad kedei yecholet l'ha'azin anchat yachid mi Yisrael, to the very point where that leader is capable of hearing a single sigh, S-I-G-H, from Israel, b'pina nidachat shebetevel, in the furthest corners of the land. So firstly, his earlobe is engaged, not just to activate some abstract angelic realm, but to tell him that your job as the high priest is not to be a man in an ivory tower, but to attune your hearing to the needs of the people, and to listen for the smallest sound of discomfort in the furthest reaches of the kingdom. Valboen yado, and it has to be on the thumb. Asher aleh liyot tamid yad asuka v'charutza, because his hands have to be constantly in motion. Yeshivat manhig v'chibuk yadayim, to have a leader sitting literally on their hands, or their hands collapse together. He ason la'am, is a tragedy, as a disaster to the people. A leader has to be engaged and active all the time, not just in the spirit that Hertz and Philo mentioned, that they have to be engaged with spiritual life, but they have to lead. They have to provide action on behalf of their people. Valboen raglo, and it has to be on their feet as well. Asher leil itzaot tamid kidima, because they have to be moving the people forward all the time. It isn't enough just to listen. It isn't enough just to act. One has to seek to improve and to progress and to make the people better. Amidam uvenet harat anusot hi, a stone statuesque gesture on the part of a leader is a tragedy. She'ein hitkadmut yoreshet nisigat mekoma, we need to progress as a people. That's the idea of Menachem Tzion. And then he goes even further, with which we'll finish. He says, we should also pay attention to where this blood came from. As we noted at the beginning, there were a whole slew of sacrifices that were made in this week's parasha, but there's only one that is used to inaugurate the high priest, and that is the Ayal HaMiluim, which was a Korban Shlamim. Who gets to eat the Shlamim? Anyone remember? It's called the Shlamim. We actually mentioned last week very briefly. It's called the Shlamim because it makes peace in a number of ways. One way of which is everybody gets a piece. A piece goes on the altar, a piece goes to the Kohanim, and a piece goes to the Onus. The Korban Shlamim is divided among God, the priest, and the people. And here Rabbi Sacks says, Hadam Hashem Moshe Hazah, the blood that he used was a Shlamim. Look at the underlined bit in the second line. Meramez, it hints, La'aron Levanav, to Aaron as his sons. Ki ha-semel shel korban ha-shlamim, the symbol of the shlamim yetamid ner l'raglam, would be the light of their path to guide them forward, that they are lo rak la'amod l'sharet et Hashem b'migdash. Their role is not just as a squad of priests hidden in the temple or sanctuary, ala aleihem l'sharet et ha'am b'chol tzarchei ha-ruach shalo, but to deal with the people in any of their culture and spiritual matters. Roe Yisrael, the shepherds of Israel and Manhigav, and its leaders, Mechuyavim Letzet Yedei Chovat HaBriot, have to serve the needs of the creation, of creatures, Lo Pachot Mashe Letzet Yedei Chovat HaMakom, no less than they are serving the needs of God. So for the Menachem Tzion, this ritualistic inauguration of Aaron HaKohen on his earlobe and his thumb and his toe is not just an arcane, mystical, allegorical ritual. It is a lesson to the high priest on how to lead the people. Number one, to attune your ear to where they are. Number two, to be busy and active in helping them. Number three, to move forwards, to progress, not just maintaining the status quo, to be proactive and to help the people. This is not a commentary on the politics of our lives. You should know, it just may coincide for some of you. And then he finishes by saying, and the very material, the very blood that is being used is a signal to him as a leader, as a religious leader in particular, that his job is to serve God, but no less than that, his job is to serve the people and to bridge the two and bring them together. We'll turn now to Maariv, and with that, I will wish you all a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.